Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's tempting to say that gentrification is a naturally occurring social phenomenon. We're here to tell you it's not, people. It's a business. Our series, York and Fig, continues today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, the 4th of December. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Our home away from home on the program this week is about 8 or 10 miles northeast of downtown Los Angeles, a bureau that our wealth and poverty team set up in a neighborhood called Highland Park this past summer. They're doing a long-term project on the economics of gentrification, the changes that happen when a poor or a working-class neighborhood suddenly finds a lot of money moving in. Because here's the deal. People move into or out of places for a whole lot of different reasons. But for investors, changing neighborhoods, gentrification, is a business. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark has that part of this story.
There's a familiar storyline you hear in lots of gentrifying neighborhoods about how all the change got started. And at some point, it usually involves a cute little cafe. In Highland Park, it's Café de Leche. In a neighborhood once known for auto body shops, taco stands, and check cashing stores, Café de Leche opened in 2008 and started selling $4 coffee drinks. Exposed brick walls, big beautiful windows, it's become a favorite hangout for laptop-toting newcomers to the neighborhood. And a favorite target for disgruntled old-timers, says Yolanda Nogueira. She's the café's landlord.
Do you want me to say it?
Yes, say it. I will bleep it.
Okay, it says, "F*** you hipsters."
Bleep You Hipsters 130 is the name of a Wi-Fi network that shows up in the cafe, set up by some angry anonymous neighbor. People have also tagged the cafe with the word gentrifier and posted a symbolic eviction notice to its door.
I don't know. It's just embarrassing and not good.
Matt and Anja Schodorf, the owners of Café de Leche, they say they completely get why some Highland Parkers might feel uncomfortable with how fast the neighborhood is changing. But the idea that their little café started it all?
It's hard to emphasize enough that we just opened a coffee shop, you know? Like, there was no master plan. It was just two people trying to make a living.
But even though Matt and Anja had no master plan to change the neighborhood, their cafe played a central role in someone else's plan, a 54-year-old professional house flipper named Steve Jones. He doesn't live here, but he's well known as the hipster flipper of Highland Park.
When I first started doing work here in this area, the only thing that really was around was Café de Leche. And I said to those guys, I said, listen, you cannot go out of business. If you got a business, I'm screwed.
To understand why Steve needed Café de Leche so bad, you need to understand a little more about Steve's business. Think of him as a major gear in the machine that drives gentrification. During the housing crash, Steve started a home flipping business that has bought, rehabbed, and sold more than 50 houses in this neighborhood, mostly foreclosures, which in a working class place like Highland Park were easy to find.
Where most people would see some sort of urban blight or decay, I was like, oh my gosh, look at all these homes I can do. I saw opportunity.
Opportunity to make a lot of money. Steve finds an investor for each house and pools money with them to buy, gut, and renovate the place with lots of modern Dwell magazine-style touches, candy-colored doors, horizontal slat fences. Then he sells each house at a nice profit.
It's this house up here on the left.
Steve took me to a three-bedroom, three-bath he did on a little hillside. The style is reimagined Spanish. Red tile roof, mint green door, marble countertops, vintage sconces.
This was one of those homes when I purchased it, it was sad. It had sort of a rough life, you could tell.
Steve bought it for $280,000, put another $140,000 into the rehab, and a few months later,
we sold it for $530,000.
That's more than a $100,000 profit in 6 months.
Oh my gosh.
But to sell houses for those kinds of prices, Steve needed people who could afford to pay that much. People already living in Highland Park, for the most part, could not. Steve needed to draw wealthier people from other areas, and he worried that urban blight and decay that he saw as an opportunity.
It might be a little bit of a shock to some people, And so one of the things for us was to show this home buyer, look at, you can live in this neighborhood.
And that is where Café de Leche fit in.
Because one of the first things that, you know, home buyers look for is like, where do I get my dry cleaning? Where do I go to get my groceries? Where do I get my coffee? And at least I could say, for the coffee, you go there.
Steve calls the cafe a tiny little seed of transformation, something he could point to and say, look, this neighborhood is changing. He needed to convince potential home buyers of this, yes, but just as important, he needed to convince the people who were giving him money to flip these homes.
OPM. Do you know what OPM is?
No.
OPM stands for other people's money. That's a lot of what I do.
Here's one of those other people.
My name is Greg Solomon. I am a retail consultant, and I also invest in real estate.
Investors like Greg Solomon are yet another gear in the gentrification machine. Greg and Steve met when they both worked at Quiksilver, the surf company. Steve was a VP there. Greg was a senior VP. Greg lives in a wealthy suburb of L.A., and like a lot of investors who've been betting on low-income neighborhoods, until recently, Greg had never actually been to Highland Park.
Driving through to go somewhere else, maybe, but I had not spent much time there.
Greg says the first time he really did spend time in the neighborhood to check out a property Steve wanted to show him, he came prepared.
I specifically drove my truck, and not our nicer car, just it was definitely a place I have to admit that I would not have gone to at night. I wouldn't have felt comfortable really driving to it at night.
This discomfort that Greg felt, this perception that Highland Park was a place to avoid, is strangely at the exact heart of what makes buying property here a potentially very lucrative investment. Or, as another real estate guy who works in Highland Park puts it,
up and coming never looks like up and coming. It looks like a bad neighborhood, you know?
Matt Manor used to buy and sell houses for Steve Jones in Highland Park until he started a flipping company of his own. He says it's basic economics. The nicer a neighborhood, the more expensive the properties. So if you invest in a nice neighborhood,
the less return you get, right?
In a rundown neighborhood where properties are cheaper, you can buy low and, if the gentrification machine is warming up, eventually sell high. It's a riskier investment, but one with potential for big reward. Here's Steve Jones again.
All these people out there that have so much money, it's sitting in some stupid money market account making, you know, 2% or 3% or whatever their horrible rates are right now. And so for me, I have to present to these people, like, look it, here's an opportunity for you. I can make you X percent on your money, and I have made these people a lot of money.
Steve's investor, Greg Solomon, says he put about $1 million over the last few years into Highland Park.
And if you had to give a ballpark percentage in terms of return on investment?
I would say I probably made 35 to 40% of my money. So, you know, you can't complain about that.
At least an investor like Greg can't complain. But of course, the whole chain reaction of gentrification has, on one end, investors like Greg Solomon, and on the other end...
You want to see my garden? I'm Martinez, so Martinez garden.
People like Andres Martinez and his family. They live in a house with a beautiful garden on a street surrounded by houses that have been bought and sold by flippers like Steve Jones and much bigger companies funded by private equity or foreign money. Some of the Martinez's neighbors lost their homes to foreclosure. Others decided to sell and cash out on rising property values. Jackie Martinez, Andres's daughter, says real estate agents and investors are constantly approaching them about their house.
Calling or sending, you know, flyers. We've had countless people come say, oh, we'll buy the property. And it's like, no, like it's home, you know?
Even if it's a home that sometimes Jackie barely recognizes.
You don't see as many, you know, the things you used to see, like the carnicerias, the markets, and the people out, you know, selling tamales and everything like that. More neighborhood feel.
But that old neighborhood feel is going to disappear if real estate investors are going to keep making big profits in Highland Park. The logic goes that carnicerias, Mexican markets, and tamale vendors on their own just won't draw enough people who can afford to buy a beautifully rehabbed Steve Jones home. For that matter, Café de Leche won't draw enough people on its own either.
Hello, briefly. Hi, my name's Steve Jones, and thanks for everyone for coming.
which is why Steve Jones, the hipster flipper, and his real estate agent have started hosting wine and cheese mixers for some of Highland Park's new shops, what he calls like-minded businesses. It's part marketing event, part support group.
I wanted to give people an opportunity to sort of socialize and to be able to connect and really, like, let other business owners know that, like, we're sort of in this together.
Steve starts off the events by asking people to go around the room and introduce themselves.
You can say your name. You can say what your business is.
I'm Jen, and I literally signed a lease at Avenue 55 and Figueroa for a bookshop today. Literally.
No Mexican butchers or tamale vendors, but there's the new bookstore owner, a hip hair salon.
Charles Wren, The Hive Los Angeles. We just opened on New York.
Also a wine boutique and farm-to-table dining.
We'll be opening up a restaurant, pizzeria, coffee shop.
Because it might just take one cute cafe to flip a few dozen houses, but it's going to take a group effort to flip a whole neighborhood. More on that tomorrow. I'm Chrissy Clark from Marketplace.
There is also more from our project on gentrification later on in this broadcast and online at yorkandfig.com. Pictures, videos, a blog, and all the reporting from our Wealth and Poverty crew. We want to hear from you as well, by the way. Tell us what gentrification looks like where you live. Take a picture, tag it, Gentrification Is, put it up on Instagram, and we'll grab it and put it on our website. On Wall Street today, some up, some down, finished, basically even. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The American economy, while technically strong and growing, the November jobs report comes out tomorrow morning, by the way, but this economy is still feeling the after effects of the Great Recession, and it's showing up in maternity wards. Data from the Centers for Disease Control show that the birth rate in this country hit an all-time low last year. Marketplace's Adam Allington explains why, apart from the obvious, and why it matters.
Never have women had so few children in the history of the U.S. The tipping point is a term called replacement-level fertility. That's just demographer speak for the number necessary to replace you and your partner, i.e. two babies. And for the longest time, that rate was sitting comfortably at around 2.1, until recently.
So that's kind of the magic number. And over the past several years, we've actually dipped below that 2.1. We're now down at around 1.9 births per woman.
Mark Mather is a demographer at the Population Reference Bureau. He says ongoing uncertainty from the Great Recession could be a factor holding down birth rates. Another is that many more women are primary breadwinners.
As more and more women are entering the workforce, we'd expect fertility rates to stay at pretty low levels.
An aging workforce, a drop-off in consumer spending, think of everything from onesies to college tuition, these are just a few of the negative economic impacts of the baby bust. But how much should we really worry?
I don't think it's an economic disaster, but it does create challenges.
David Lamb is an economist at the University of Michigan's Population Studies Center. The theory, he says, is that as economic conditions improve, people will start having more babies. But even if we don't, many other economies are doing just fine.
Germany's doing quite well, relatively speaking, with a lower fertility rate than we have.
Absent economic incentives to get in a family way, Lamb says immigration is one button policymakers might still push to help drive the recovery. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
You remember the long-suffering e-reader from Barnes & Noble, the Nook? Man, don't feel bad if you don't. It never really went anywhere, which is why there has been talk, really, for more than a year that Barnes & Noble would split itself into two companies, with basically the books on one side and the Nook on the other. Today, that split might have gotten a bit closer. Barnes & Noble said it's made a deal with Microsoft to buy back the software company's roughly 17% stake in the Nook, which could clear the way for a split, perhaps, by summertime. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explores why Barnes & Noble might want to split from the Nook and how these kinds of spin-offs usually work.
If you were to write the story of Barnes & Noble today, booksellers would probably file it under mystery, because it's still unclear how this chapter in the company's history will end.
The issue is still which parts they actually want to spin out.
John Tinker is an analyst at Maxim, an investment bank and brokerage firm. Barnes & Noble has its regular retail stores and a series of college bookstores.
And then a large equity interest in Nook, which is both a hardware company and a software company.
Which means the company spans retail, tech, and education. Tinker says investors often prefer simpler structures. It seems as though Barnes & Noble wants to split its stores from the Nook. Emily Feldman is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. She says to get rid of a division, a company generally has three options.
They could wind it down. They could just sort of liquidate the assets. Presumably, they could try to find a buyer for it, or they can spin it off.
Feldman says the Nook still has some value, though finding a buyer could be tough. She says HP, eBay, and Symantec have done spinoffs recently.
In general, the reason that companies will want to undertake spinoffs is that they'll have two separate parts of their business, or more than two sometimes, that basically are facing very different growth trajectories.
If Barnes & Noble did spin off the Nook, it'd likely issue new stock in a separate company to existing shareholders, letting them decide whether to hold the stock and stick with the Nook or try and sell. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Coming up.
We completely disguised anything that wasn't appealing about it with just beautiful pieces. And that house sold in one day for $400,000 over asking.
Making a gentrifying neighborhood look good. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 12 points today, less than a 10%, closed at 17,900 on the nose. The Nasdaq shrugged off 5 points, a 10%, 4769. The S&P 500 dipped 2 points, a 10%. 2071. Saudi Arabia cut prices on oil it's going to deliver to the U.S. next month, and oil futures fell below $67 a barrel, which gets us to shale oil drillers here in the United States. Kodiak oil and gas down 3%, 55% for the year. Northern oil and gas down 7.3% today, 66.0% for the year. But wait, do not take your money out of shale oil and put it in teen clothing brands that rely on their logos, people. Aeropostale reported sales down 12%. Today, shares fell off the rack 22% today, 77.0% for the year. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues the November jobs report. December is National Fruitcake Month, and Prohibition ended on December 5th, 1933, when the 21st Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was ratified, giving you more options to wash down that fruitcake. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There is a report out from the Labor Department today about minimum wage and how many people aren't getting it. Specifically, in California and New York, as many as 6.5% of workers get less than the law says they have to. Steve Greenhouse covers labor for the New York Times. He had the story in the paper today. Steve, it's good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Do me a favor and nationalize these numbers for me. If the Labor Department extrapolated out, what would it mean nationwide?
The department estimates that this would mean more than 2 million workers not paid the minimum wage every week, and that's out of 150 million workers in the workforce.
Who are these workers with these tens of millions of dollars worth of lost income? Younger, older, men, women, what do we know?
They're generally younger. And when I interviewed people from the Labor Department yesterday, we agreed that many of them are undocumented. And perhaps these numbers even understate the problem, because when the Census Department was going around doing its survey, it generally undercounts, underinterviews undocumented. But these are, your fast food workers, your cashiers, your, big box store workers, your hotel workers. American businesses are very innovative and entrepreneurial, and many are also very innovative in figuring out ways to shortchange their workers on pay.
What are the ancillary costs, I guess you might say, right? Because when people don't have paychecks coming in, things happen and things don't get done, and other sources of funding have to come up.
For me, one of the most surprising findings of this report is that in New York, in California, the cost of these minimum wage violations push thousands more people under the poverty line and cost both states tens of millions of dollars in terms of higher food stamp costs, higher school lunch costs for the kids in poor families. And if you extrapolated that nationwide, it would certainly go into the hundreds of millions. And I guess every year or two, over $1 billion.
Give me the mechanics of how it works. It's not like these companies are paying $6.25 an hour straight up. That's not the amount that shows up on the paycheck. How does it happen physically? Do you know?
I think there's several ways. You know, sometimes workers will work, you know, say 50 hours a week and will not get overtime for the last 10 hours, and that brings them under the minimum wage. I've done front page stories for the Times about companies that go into the computer to erase hours that people work. And so that maybe you've worked 45 hours and whoops, your paycheck will be just 38 hours. And oftentimes workers don't even recognize that because they don't do a very good job keeping track of how many hours they work.
You've been doing this a long time, as you just said, and maybe this is a cynical question, but does this surprise you, this data?
Actually, yes, Kai. I was surprised by the extent of the numbers. They show that between 3.5 and 6.5% of all wage and salary workers face minimum wage violations each week. If you had asked me, I would have guessed it was 1 or 2%. So these numbers are really surprising. And I should also note, Labor Secretary Perez says that, you know, by far the vast majority of employers comply with the law and are on the up and up. But there are some low-road employers, and they break the law, and they pressure the good guys to break the law. And that's why they're really trying to crack down on the bad actors.
Steve Greenhouse is the labor and workplace reporter for the New York Times. Steve, thanks very much.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Chrissy Clark was telling us up at the top of the program about how investors, flippers, one might say, will come into a neighborhood that's changing, buy houses, fix them up, and then sell them at a profit. That is one specific kind of business. But there's a whole economy built around gentrification, including making those homes that get flipped look really good.
All right, let's round them up. Okay, this house is 1,352 square feet, 3-bedroom, 1.5 bath, and it was built in 1909. I'm Cordelia Reynolds, and I am part owner in Platform Home Staging.
My name is Sarah Brady. I'm the co-owner of Platform Home Staging and the owner of Platform the Store. Our sort of tagline is handcraft.
What is that? Aesthetic.
Yes.
Eclectically curated.
Yeah. Oh my God, I forgot it.
Sarah, this is a fur from like an antique, a sheepskin.
We are anti-TV, we're anti-computer, no fake TVs, no fake computers, ever, no.
And it's always a struggle because so many buyers like want to know where their TV is going to go. But to stage with a television, like when you could have a beautiful piece of art, it's just really strange.
I think we're like, you're trying to like tell the dream of like, oh, this is how your house could be if you didn't actually have any clutter or, you know, it's like everybody walks in and go, oh, this is how I want to live, you know? I want to live here. I want to move in.
I don't know. I think it's a lot. It's a little too bold. Let's try that.
Well, when you're inspired by a project, like, oh, your juices are flowing. You're, like, dreaming about how to arrange the furniture at night before you go to bed. I get, like, crazy visions. I'm like, oh, my God, I just got the vision of the built-in. I'm gonna do it. I'm going to do it just like that. And then I do it, and then the Cordelia is like, amazing!
No, really. Flippers are all about the bottom line.
Oh my God,
so when they see the return on it in a big way, and they're coming back, like, I do think there's going to be like more of a movement into people seeing the value in a design space for sale.
We're in the home stretch here.
Yeah, go.
Yeah.
Okay. We did like a mansion in Los Feliz a little bit ago, and we completely disguised anything that wasn't appealing about it with just beautiful pieces. And that house sold in one day for $400,000 over asking.
The prices are just so crazy, you know, and like Highland Park, obviously. It just like blew up in the last year. But like real estate's crazy all over Los Angeles, but certainly like the migration into Highland Park happened very quickly.
I've seen a lot of, you know, kind of hip, younger folks moving into the neighborhood, and a lot of them are having kids. It's creatives who are looking to settle down in a cool neighborhood and be part of a community, and I think Highland Park offers that. It's like its own little town.
The house in that piece that they were working on, by the way, sold for just under $700,000. $55,000 over the asking price. You can see what it looks like before and after pictures at yorkinfig.com.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which comes courtesy of the Washington Post, and in which we find out, because we can, thank you, Internet, which government agencies get sworn at the most. A website called regulations.gov offers an online database of the public comments that people send in when the aforementioned agencies propose new rules, which they do all the time. The Post focused, it should be said, on two specific and very common cuss words, which I will not say in case the kids are nearby, but you can probably guess. Anyway, so guesses as to which government agency got sworn at the most? Come on, if you didn't say the Internal Revenue Service, I don't think you've been paying attention, right? The Fish and Wildlife Service, for some reason, was number two. I don't quite understand that. The recipient of the fewest epithets? Something called the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Administration. So there you go. All right, we're out of here. The Dow off 12 points today, less than a 10%. The NASDAQ down 5 points, about a 10%. The S&P 500 dropped 2 points, a 10% there. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Managing editor around here is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.